don't want to go any bigger after all?
She looks over her shoulder to ask me this, resting the folds of her chin on her shoulder, eyebrows raised.
No. I did think about it, but no.
Okay, your choice. I can tell she's disappointed, but the tattoo is for me. I don't want it to draw too much attention from other people.
I don't watch her get the equipment ready. Instead, I roll my head to the side and look at the array of inkings that cover the back wall. It's like a tapestry. The frames blend into the black paint and into each other. As I focus on each one, I am presented with a short holographic film of the tattoo's owner rolling up a sleeve or lifting a top to expose the design on their body. An elderly lady sticks out her tongue as she tugs down the back of her trousers. I giggle as Brooke settles into her chair and wheels it towards me. I close my eyes because I don't want to see the contraption she's holding again.
Yep, she was a character.
I feel the cool tingle of Brooke wiping something over my ankle, and I realize I'm holding my breath.
Get ready for the pain, she announces with glee.
I hum approval and fight against the nervous tension building in my foot, the toes squeezing against each other. She should realize that telling me it's going to hurt will only make it hurt more. I try to distract myself from the compulsion to pull my foot away by thinking of the day that has just passed. A typical day in so many ways. Updating records, checking on dying clients, confirming access agreements, showing Claire a glimpse of her heaven. But the adrenaline pulses at my temples, fizzing behind my eyes. I bite down on my lip and clench my fists as the needle begins to buzz. My brain has ramped up the tension, already decided upon the fact that pain is imminent. When it comes, it's a bearable kind of pain, like the scratch of a jab to draw blood. You know it is for the best, and as the needle starts to gnaw at my skin, it's no more or less unpleasant than I expected. During my training, the lecturer talked to us about the brain preparing for death, as if it was some kind of sentient being of its own, an alien in your body. It disturbed me for weeks, this idea. I kept dreaming about my brain walking up and down the stairs of my apartment building on cartoon-like legs, angry little fists pressed into the folds of grey matter where its hips might have been. I'd be inside my apartment, listening to it stomp around and bang on the door. But I wouldn't let it in. I haven't had that dream for years. The brain prepares for death. Perhaps, right now, Yarrick's brain is beginning to accept its fate. Despite his fortitude, I could see that his eyes were resigned. I try to blink the image away, but the green of his irises glimmer beneath my lids like bright lights stared at too long. The eyes close first. People who are dying sleep more and more as their metabolism fades. The brain shifts into a withdrawn, comatose state as it starts to let go. But it doesn't stop listening. Hearing is the last of the senses to go. I always wondered why. Why would we not save the last of our mental faculties for speech or for clasping hands or kissing the cheeks of our loved ones? Now I'm a bit older, I can see why there's more value in listening. Most of my clients reach the point at which they have nothing more to say. The last session or two can sometimes verge on the awkward. We often cover old ground, review their heavens one last time, and then we listen to the silence for a moment, before their regrets begin to surface. I've heard them all. The desire to see grandchildren grow up, the wish to have seen the south of France, The unfulfilled need to get arrested by the police and spend the night in a cell. Some are stranger than others. Some are laced with laughter to try to hide the unabridged honesty of the words. But I've realized over the years that all these wishes and regrets amount to the same thing. We always want more. We want to learn more and feel more, right up until that last breath. Our brains are desperate to gather what they can from our short lives. We are always listening, always hoping for something else. Yarick's laugh breaks into my meditation, and as I feel the needle plunge into a new point near my ankle bone, a familiar sensation flickers between my thighs. Oh, no, 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 Isabel, I think.
Nearly done for today,
Brooke says, as if she's noticed my eyes opening. Her voice grates more than the needle. It's as if she has broken some sort of sacred silence, and I'm irritated. I feel like there must be pus or blood, or at least some kind of cellular fluid leaking from my ankle onto the bed. But when I raise my head to look, all I can see is the outline of an angel emerging around my ankle bone. I listen to the buzz of the needle, intermittent now as I imagine her filling in the finer details. A tattoo. Dom will think I've lost my mind. But maybe I'll tell him that I've expanded it.
An angel? He'll ask, his eyes wide.
Some people call me their angel, I'll say, laughing it off, placing my palms together in front of my chest, pouting and gazing skywards. But it won't be the truth. The angel isn't me. It isn't meant to be my client's perception of me. It is a reminder of what I might be taking away from them. Chapter 4. The rumbling rouses me, and I refuse to open my eyes at first, willing myself back to sleep. My chip doesn't vibrate in warning, as I've set it up to do if a serious event occurs nearby. No emergency public announcement flashes across my vision or issues instructions directly into my ear canal. It's most likely a rubbish truck in the street outside. It's gone 4 a.m. I need to go back to sleep, I tell myself. But what if it's something else? I'm out of the covers and the chill of the still bedroom air cloaks my body. I find myself opening the door onto the landing, where the window looks out over the back street. The planes are shadows against the moonless night, but I feel them in my chest as they cross overhead. They are so low. My heart rocks against my ribcage, out of sync with the shivering of my naked skin. The two motions disagree, forcing nausea up from my stomach. I stare at the sky open-mouthed, my fingertips pressed against the cold glass. I must be imagining it. I must be dreaming. I awaken to the clock digits projected by my chip onto my eye lens. As my consciousness fades in, I realize a few hours have passed. I yawn and flex my feet, feeling the rawness of the tattoo on my lower leg as it rubs against the sheets. I realize I'm waking not to the artificial sunlight of my alarm, but to Don nuzzling my neck. For a moment I succumb, stretching and then curling into his body, basking in his warmth. He only got back last night, but he'll be leaving again tomorrow. He's catching the train to the coast to see his ex-girlfriend and their kids. I should care. I know I should. But somehow it doesn't bother me. He kisses my cheek, and I can feel the emerging stubble on his usually clean-shaven chin. I try to think of a reason to push him away, and then I remember that I have a meeting today, first thing. I have a breakfast meeting,
I try to whisper, but find that I'm unable to temper my voice amid my tiredness. It comes out almost like a shout, and I think it disturbs me as much as it does him.
All right, all right, Don sighs. No time for just a...
He runs his hands over my bare belly, pressing the base of his hand into the hollow of my hip. No. I'm sorry, darling. Tonight, maybe, or tomorrow, before you go. He makes a grumbling noise and rolls away from me. I tap him on the shoulder. I had a nightmare, I think, about these huge planes flying overhead. It seems so real.
Oh, I'm sorry, honey.
Is something happening? Do you know anything? He turns back towards me, one eye open over the duvet.
Don't worry,
he mumbles.
It sounds worse in the media than it is. The US Pacific Command reckon they've got it all in hand.
You trust the Americans? He rolls his eyes in response. He is always so evasive, as if telling me not to worry will make me think the event I fear less likely rather than more so. I know he can't tell me what he does. I simply have to hope that if he had warning of something serious, he would make sure I was safe. I've got to get up, I say. Sleeping naked offers the illusion of youth and cleanliness and feeling carefree, but it makes it so much harder to get up in the morning. I roll out of bed and stretch and jiggle on the spot, shaking my bed-rumpled curls of dark hair over my shoulders. I can feel Don's lascivious smile upon me as he watches. I zip around the bed, arms wrapped across my breasts to fend off the cold air. Before I open the door, I look back at him, wrapped up in the duvet to his chin. His eyes wander over my body, and a frown flickers over his face as he catches sight of the tattoo on my ankle. He won't voice his opinion on it again now because his eyes are being drawn to other things. I should feel lucky that after 4 years I have a man who still looks at me like this.
You look beautiful this morning,
he says, so softly that I know he means it. But beautiful things are never perfect. On time is too late for me. I like to be early. And so I'm sitting in the sun-drenched meeting room at the back of the clinic before anyone else has arrived. There's no buzzing in my neck, no cues popping up in my vision from my lens. I feel content alone here with my cooling coffee, wearing a freshly pressed grey trouser suit, and with my codex unfurled in front of me. I soak in the cool, clear peace of the room, closing my eyes and letting the brightness of it colour my eyelids pink. I undo my hair tie from the nape of my neck. I pull the tangled mass over one shoulder and tug my fingers through to the ends. I have no idea how it gets this unruly in a ponytail. This time I plait it, pushing the braid back over my ear. I unbutton the collar of my shirt and brush the broken ends of hair from the lapels of my suit jacket. There's a loose thread raising itself like a charmed snake along the seam. This is my best jacket, the most expensive one I could afford. I fight the temptation to nip back to my office, take the small pair of scissors from the drawer under the coffee table, and snip the thread away. There's a polite knock at the door, and the sudden noise jolts me. A granule of coffee falls from the edge of my cup onto the breast of my shirt. I grimace and blow it away. Only Harry would knock to join a meeting he'd been invited to. He enters, followed by Caleb and a woman I don't recognize. Harry raises a hand in his characteristic greeting and grins.
Morning, Isabel. This is Maya Denton. She's rolling out single optin for the state.
Hi,
I stand up and extend my hand across the meeting table. She takes it as limply as I offer it. I can't blame her for that. I can feel Caleb's eyes burning into me as he sits down. When will he learn that his demands have the opposite effect to the one he desires?
It's a pleasure,
she drawls in a grainy southern accent.
I just wish these jet-lag drugs were more effective.
I force a smile at her, taking my seat again and swirling the coffee around in the cup. I watch her arrange the feathery layers of her hair and straighten her wrap dress. Caleb jumps back up.
Can I get you a drink, Maya?
He asks, shooting me a look as he does so, as if it's my job to make coffee for other people.
No, I'm all good, thanks, Caleb,
she replies, stifling a yawn.
The pills should be better than caffeine.
As I expected, Leela enters the room last, looking flustered. Her black hair curls haphazardly around her face, and I can tell she's applied her deep red lipstick on the train. There's a small smudge beneath her nose, but it's too late to point it out to her now. Her disorganized state never fails to cheer me up in the mornings. It's a wonder that she has become the manager of anything, let alone the best heaven architecture firm in the city.
Morning, all!
She calls out, with an air of unforced enthusiasm, closing the door behind her. No one pulls out a chair for her. They know by now that she doesn't sit.
Maya, Caleb, Harry!
She flutters her fingers in a wave as she strolls across the room.
Isabel?
She pauses to rest her hand on my shoulder and grins down at me with affection. She wanders around the table until her back is against the plain white wall. Sunlight flows down one side of her. She unfurls her codex on the table and tucks in her shirt. I can see she isn't wearing a belt, and I'm tempted to roll my eyes at her.
Now, everyone, she says. The lovely Maya has come all the way from California to be here with us. We're going to give her the weekend in London to settle in, and then she'll be working with us as of next week.
She pauses and looks at us all in turn, as if she's expecting some kind of applause on behalf of Maya.
So, Maya, you already know Caleb, our director. Harry here is our lead junior architect, and this is Isabel, our longest-serving one.
I incline my head and raise my eyebrows. It's the way she always introduces me, longest-serving. Perhaps it's only me that thinks this phrase lends a whiff of inferiority to my 10 years here at Oakley. I think of all the words she could have used instead. Most experienced would have done. Leela has noticed me glaring at her, and it has thrown her train of thought.
Our longest serving and our best, she adds, smiling brightly at me. Perhaps even the best.
It's an honor. Isabel,
says Maya, tapping her fingers upon the table as if to emphasize her pleasure.
I've heard a lot about you, enough to know that you're an absolute asset to this company.
I incline my head in way of appreciation, but Maya has already turned back to Leela, who is flicking through notes on her codex.
Now, Maya, would you mind giving us a little bit of background about yourself and what we'll be working on implementing next week?
Sure.
Maya stands up and walks to the end of the table.
As I'm sure you know, I direct Valhalla based out of San Diego and Mumbai.
She runs her fingertips along the edge of the table and speaks slowly, carefully, directing her attention at each of us in turn.
I think we've earned a good little reputation for ourselves over the years.
Everyone apart from me dutifully acknowledges her with nods and hums of agreement as she purses her lips and flicks her long blonde hair back over her shoulders. Valhalla is the foremost heaven architecture firm in the Northern Hemisphere.
The MIT neuroscientists that originally developed the concept of engineered heavens and founded the company years ago were quick to move across to the other side of the country. I can only imagine they wanted warmth, sunshine, and scantily clad women in bikinis to go with their billions.
What I'm mainly here to talk to you all about is the move to shift away from the double opt-in clause.
This again. I clear my throat and take the last swig of my drink. For fuck's sake, I mutter.
Isabel,
says Leela. Caleb is flexing his jaw and furiously avoiding my gaze. Sorry, sorry. I tut at myself and gesture at my shirt. Coffee. I can feel her glaring at me as I rub at the spot where the stray grain of coffee fell from my cup onto the pristine fabric. Carry on, Maya.
Sure. So, the single opt-in clause. As you'll have no doubt heard, we've been successful in gathering support in the States. The bill has just been passed by the House of Representatives, and we're hoping for the Senate to vote upon it in the next few months. There may be further amendments, but our lobbyist in the White House is convinced that we've got a good chance of getting it past the president. With any luck, single opt-in will be made statute by the end of this year, and we'd like to see the UK follow suit.
And we're going along with this, are we? I ask, directing my eyes towards Leela.
We believe it's the right direction to move in, yes,
she replies curtly. There's a pleading look in her eyes.
If you have any concerns, Isabel, we can talk about them. Yes, I have concerns,
I exclaim, cutting her off.
Any individual should have the right not to be used in anyone else's heaven. It's the only way the system can work, morally.
I can feel my pulse rising.
But we're talking only about memories, recollections, said Maya. No, that's simply not true. That does a disservice to what we do. I create far more than just memories for my clients.
I take a deep breath, trying to check my temper.
And call me idealistic, but I believe that only truly loving relationships should meet the criteria. Relationships with double opt-in.
I slap my hand against the table to mark my point.
I have plenty of memories in here about my ex-husband.
Maya taps her head and pushes her shoulders back. She is admirably unruffled.
Unluckily for me, they're stuck there. They are my memories. Therefore, I have ownership of them. They don't belong to him, so why should he have any say whether he's in my heaven?
Your choice of example somewhat evades the point. I wait for her to challenge me, but she waits, painting an image of calm across her face.
Let me ask you this. Would it be okay if a man could take memories of a child he has abused into his heaven? Would it be acceptable to you if an unconvicted rapist could carry on attacking you again and again in his mind until the end of time?
The current law is in place for a reason, Maya.
Isabel, that's enough.
Caleb's voice is quiet yet commanding. I let it sway me.
I do understand what you're saying, says Maya, angling her body towards me.
She is trying to be gracious.
We can discuss it further while I'm here, if you like.
Fine. Caleb swivels away from me to address the rest of the table.
Isabel's personal opinions are a good reminder that the media isn't exactly on side with the idea of single opt-in, he says. I mean, some remain entirely against artificial heavens. Those idiots in their placards stood outside our front door still grab the odd headline.
Granted, Maya says, bobbing her head. I'd say it's been quite an active campaign back home to get the media to highlight the positives of the change. In the States, far more so than here, anti-heaven sentiment is generally quite strong. There's a hell of a lot of talk about lost souls.
A laugh is tinny, and I clench my jaw. With their money, Valhalla could bribe anyone.
Leela,
says Caleb.
We need to look at who in the media we can reach out to. Public influence is key.
Leela twitches her lips in thought as I glare at her.
There's James at the Mail, and we've got close ties with a lot of bloggers.
Yeah, get me in for an interview or something.
Caleb is already moving on, flicking through his codex.
So, we'll need someone to arrange some more meetings next week with Maya to discuss all this further, and to draw up a list of points to discuss in advance. Harry?
I'll do it, I say. It's fine, I know how it should be done.
No, Harry will do it.
Caleb speaks without looking up. Harry glances at me, pressing his lips together in apology, and scribbles a note into the air, recording it into his lens.
I think we're nearly done here, says Leela, rolling up her codex. Caleb, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes, sure.
Caleb stands up from his chair and plants his fingertips on the table, leaning over it. Maya smiles at him serenely.
I know I've spoken to each of you individually about this over the last few weeks, but I just wanted to say that Valhalla continues to be interested in buying the company. I know this makes for an unsettling time as we proceed with negotiations, but I want to reassure you all that if the merger does go through, nothing at Oakley will change.
He looks at each of us in turn, and I almost believe him.
Our jobs will be protected,
Harry asks, looking more closely at the table than at Caleb.
Yes, of course. Oakley is its architect.
I try to pay attention to the rest of the meeting, but I feel too riled up. Finally, Maya stops droning and the meeting is drawn to a close. She leaves, flanked by Harry and Caleb, who both avoid looking at me as they leave the room.
Is?
Leela calls me as I'm walking out of the door. She's leaning against the floor-to-ceiling window, arms folded. She hates confrontation, so her tone only goes to show that she loves me, really.
Yep. You're not going to get anywhere if you keep behaving like that, you know.
I turn back, leaning against the doorframe so that it presses between my shoulder blades. My hands find their way inside my pockets and I tilt back my head. I sigh.
Enlighten me, Leela. Where do I want to get to? Come on, Izzy. Don't be like that with me. I'm speaking as your friend, not as your manager.
I know, and I'm saying that your point is irrelevant.
Sorry, I didn't mean to...
I study her fallen face. The mid-morning light softens the strong nose and sharp cheekbones inherited from her Iranian father. Do I look upset? I ask her, smiling. And I'm not, of course. Not with her, just at the system. A system that is starting to scare me. Leela shakes her head and sighs as she walks towards me. She knows what will fix this.
Wine after work?
I turn and walk out of the door, giving her a thumbs up over my shoulder. As I step into the lobby, she's already caught up with me. She squeezes my shoulders and squeals into my ear.
Oh, hang on,
I say, spinning around to face her and thinking of my promise to Don. Sorry, I can't do tonight. She sticks out her bottom lip. I can do tomorrow, though.
Okay,
she says. She winks, and I wink back. I leave her in the lobby, and I walk down the corridor, back towards my office, trailing my gaze over the Carrara marble tiles. I don't have much time for socializing, for friendships, but Leela's gentle presence always reassures me. Yet anger still simmers in my chest. I have got to know enough clients that I understand the delicacies of their situations. Double opt-in is a deal-breaker for me. If it's thrown out, I will not do this, I tell myself. I will not do this anymore. When Caleb reaches out and touches my arm from the doorway of his office, I feel as though he's been listening to my thoughts.
Come in, please, Isabel.
His voice is low and crisp. He glares, and I realize how little he knows me, because if he did, he would understand that I'm easily riled for a fight. He would be best advised to play a gentler game. But Caleb isn't the kind of man to accept guidance. To look at, he's perfect with his smooth skin, leonine brown eyes and dark blonde hair. I've seen him in the gym on occasion, forcing his way through chest presses with heavy grunts, and as a result, he's sturdy. A brick wall that lets nothing in.
To what do I owe this pleasure, I wonder, Cal? I say as I move past him into the office and sit down on his deep green leather chair.
I lean forward and place my elbows on his desk, folding my fingers together under my chin in defiance. He slams the door and looks as though he might scream in fury. It only serves to focus the anger in my belly into a tighter, more determined knot.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
He demands, leaning over the table towards me.
I'm telling you, telling her, what I think.
I force an artificial calm into my voice that I know will only serve to infuriate him further.
You've told me before that you value my honesty.
Well, I don't remember saying that, but if I did, I must have been lying. I value your competence, Isabel, and quite frankly, that's about it.
My competence?
I'm astounded he could be so dismissive.
I'm the best architect in the country, and you know it.
I'm annoyed as soon as I say the words because I've exposed myself. I've let my emotions play upon my face.
And if you're really going to sell Oakley to Valhalla, or anyone else for that matter, I'm worth quite a lot to you, no?
Get out of my seat.
I feel his hand fasten around my elbow. I rarely feel fragile, but I look down and see that his thumb and middle finger meet on the inside of my arm. I stand opposite him, looking up into the strong lines of his face. His hand is still wrapped around my arm, and I see a fleeting weakness in his expression as our bodies move closer. It's a thought I've had before. He wants me. I press my lips together as I think about this solid, powerful man being swayed by a small, slight woman like myself. I bet he likes to be dominated, stood over, hurt. I feel his fingers detach from my arm, and I adjust the sleeve of my jacket, pulling it back to my wrist. I grip my teeth. Here goes.
I cannot support single opt-in. If it goes through, I'm out of here.
He glares at me, and I can only guess at the thoughts that battle inside his head. He can't afford to lose me. The clinic's excellent reputation, and more importantly right now, its market value, are largely thanks to me. But the money, always the money. He always wants more clients, specifically rich ones lacking in morals. The sort of men who want to be able to have their ex-wives in their heavens without their permission, so that they can do whatever they want with them. I think about the people I've known who might choose to feature me in their artificial afterlife, and it makes me squirm. Although I wouldn't be there to experience it, it would be no less of a violation. Caleb still hasn't spoken. He has nowhere to take this discussion. He was responding to his temper, as usual, by dragging me into his office. "Is there anything else?" I ask.
"I won't let you destroy my business, Isabel," he whispers, leaning so close to my face that I can feel his breath. If I was attracted to him, his strength of character would be desirable. He moves around me and sits down in his chair, leaning back and drawing one foot up to rest on his knee.
"Things are better than ever for us. The merger would be a good thing.
And we reward you well, don't we? I don't understand what else you want."
It's a change of tack, and I realize I prefer him angry to wheedling. "I have enough to get by." I'm dismissive, knowing full well that he can't afford to pay me any more than he already does. It's an excellent salary, more than I ever imagined I'd earn, and he knows that I do this job because I love it. I just try not to think about how much profit he skims off the top line. "But I'm not like you, Cal. I actually care about what I do. I care about my clients and their families and their loved ones." He nods as if he understands, but I don't think he does. I'm not sure he has the capacity to understand love. I swallow the emotion that's rising in my throat and fold my arms before continuing. "And I wonder what will happen if we officially go to war. If our troops stop sitting on the sidelines and take a military stand alongside Taiwan." He laughs.
"Then business will be booming."
"I signed off my first soldier yesterday," I tell him, although I'm sure he's already on top of my client list. "And she was too young, too full of life to have to look at her death." The wetness in my eyes surprises me, and I have to blink it away.
"Too young to face death? Are you kidding, Isabel?"
He never shortens my name.
"I know we're used to dealing with the old and the sick, but she's a soldier. I think they're well acquainted with the idea of dying."
I know what he means, and I can't explain why it upsets me so much. I think of the wonder that glowed from Claire's face as she exited the simulation. "It was amazing," she said to me, and I recognize the strange feeling that's curled up behind my eyes as guilt. What if it's not amazing? What if her heaven is lacking in something, devoid of some crucial factor that none of us has ever calculated for? Like all my clients, she trusts me completely, and I am never completely sure if I am deserving of it. I don't experience the final product. That's the ultimate problem with this system.
"If we go to war, actually go to war, not more of this endless standoff, then how will we cope? How will we keep up?"
She didn't ask me, but I can't even promise Claire that we would get to her body in time. I'm working myself up, I know it, but the caged words fly out of me because I say them aloud so rarely. "So many could die so far away, and it'll be a huge mess. People will die, and I don't understand how we can even begin to ensure we carry out our obligations to our existing clients, let alone all those others."
"Isabel, Isabel."
His tone is comforting now, and it's almost believable.
"You can't think like this. It might never happen, you know that."
I nod.
"What does your government boyfriend say?"
By asking the question, he's admitted his own fear. "He's been away a lot. He tells me what you've just told me, not to worry." Caleb lets his chin drop to his chest.
Can I go?
I ask him, letting the irritation creep back into my voice. I have a client arriving soon. I don't have to consult my notes to know that it's Yarrick. It's as if I can sense him getting closer, placing his hands upon the copper handle of the front door and leaning his weight into it. I feel a slight dizziness descend.
Yes,
Caleb sighs. Go.
We'll speak to Meyer about the single opt-in next week.
Chapter 5. The second meeting is almost as important as the first. It's the point at which you leave social politeness behind and get stuck into the nitty-gritty of building a client's heaven. It can be a tricky shift to negotiate. I'm watching Yarrick now, as he sits opposite me. It's lucky I make recordings of all our sessions because I'm trying to listen, but my attention is drawn to his face. I'm focused on watching the interplay of emotions as he talks, as he tells me more about the highs of his life and his hopes for his heaven. Like most of my clients, he is full of contradictions. My fingers move from the string of small cream pearls around my neck to the matching drop earrings that I can feel pulling on my lobes. The skin there feels hot to the touch. Perhaps it's a reaction. I'm not used to wearing jewelry, but when I got dressed today, I wanted to feel like a woman, as well as an architect. A shadow seems to pass across his face, and I almost turn to see if anything is blocking the window. His forehead creases, and he stops speaking mid-sentence. You're in pain? I find myself reaching out for his hand, but the cool of his skin makes me recoil. He nods.
You don't have anything, do you? Any painkillers?
No, I'm sorry, I say. Not here.
Not here?
I'm reluctant to expand, but I can see the torment etched on his face, and it has latched onto my half-hidden meaning in desperation. Just at home, for personal use.
Serious strength ones? You need them?
I got hold of some opioids while my mother was ill. I'm not the bravest. The idea of being in pain and not being able to do anything about it unsettles me.
Unsettled is, quite deliberately, not the right word.
It terrifies me almost as much as Yarrick's piercing gaze does now. I berate myself for sharing such personal information. I'm not licensed to dispense medication, I add. He hums in response and crosses his hands over his chest, squeezing his shoulders. I'm keen to move on, and I turn my attention back to my notes on the coffee table, trying to remember what it was we were talking about. So, we've talked about your initial thoughts on imagery and settings, I say. Another important thing we need to consider early on is emotions. What's in and what's out. I'm eager to hear his reply. It's always interesting to find out what people think about this. Society is obsessed with happiness.
Where to start?
He sucks in his breath and frowns.
Depression, please. Some resentment and jealousy would be good, and perhaps a dash of insecurity.
I hold my face still as I wait for him to crack. 2 seconds pass before he launches a sparkling grin at me. But his eyes are challenging. I see the pride firing behind them. I can see that he won't ask me to explain what I mean, and I'm momentarily tempted not to. But I am not Isabel in this room. I am a heaven architect to a dying man. I must push my ego aside. Some people find it strange that I ask them about this. I spread my hands and then lay them over my knees.
Not you, of course. We're talking hypothetically, the gesture says.
But imagine if you felt nothing but happiness all the time.
I purse my lips and narrow my eyes at him.
Well, I guess I'd be pretty damn happy.
He taps the table definitively and then leans back into the sofa. There's something about the way he rests his cheekbone upon his fist and angles his gaze at me, rising to my bait. It transports me out of this office. We could be anywhere.
But you wouldn't, would you? You'd almost be numb.
True happiness is only cast from shadows in the same way that light is only framed by shade.
You want me to embrace my darkness?
He asks.
Are you sure?
The half-smile doesn't leave his face, and I feel like he's asking me so much more. I take a deep breath, and the oxygen vibrates in my lungs. Yes, I murmur. A little. Yarrick rests his head back on the sofa as if he's a child settling down for a bedtime story. One way I do it is by giving people the memory of negative emotions, I continue. It frames your experience without veiling it. You could select a particular memory or choose the feeling of an emotion unlinked to any experience. Both work.
What would you do?
Here we are again, talking about me. I don't know how he turns the conversation around like this so smoothly. I consider his question, but I cannot answer it. It feels as though we've left the office again and are somewhere else. It's like swimming in unfamiliar waters. A glance at the time. We're coming to the end of today's session, I say, relieved. So have a think about what I've just said, and we can talk it through next time. He nods, but I can see he's still deep in thought. His cheeks are pulled in, sharpening the line of his jaw. His lips are pressed into a pout. I stand, and he dutifully follows me towards the door. Give the office a call if there's anything you want to discuss in the meantime. I rebuke myself. We do not dish out our time for free at Oakley. Every minute is billed. But I am a planet in orbit, moving away from him into winter. I don't want him to leave. His eyes meet mine, and the pupils are wide and deep, sorrowful.
You choose to experience a memory, right?
He asks, and I wonder how he knows.
Something sad?
My thoughts spiral, and I look away. It's too intimate a question, I know that. I hesitate, but it would be easier to just let the words come out. I am gripping the door handle, standing at the boundary of my professional life. I am almost not in my office. I am almost not his architect.
Your mother, right? You choose to remember her dying?
My eyes snap back to his, and he must know that he's right.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have brought that up.
His voice is soft, and he lets several seconds pass in silence, resting his gaze on his shoes. They are scruffy in comparison to my freshly shined brogues.
But I still don't really understand, Yarrick continues. Why wouldn't you only choose to remember the good times?
Because grief shapes the love that came before it. I am still wondering why he's closed his eyes when I feel his hand against my face. Perplexed, I stare back at his eyelids as his lips graze the corner of my mouth. He presses the pad of his thumb into the pillow of my cheek. My lips part into the silence, but then he is whispering that he is sorry,
The door is opening, and he is gone. I should want to get back to Don as soon as possible, but I decide to walk home. It's over an hour from the clinic to our Earl's Court apartment, and it's a pleasant route if the weather's good. I usually skirt along the edge of Hyde Park and then cut through the residential back streets of Knightsbridge and South Kensington. I do it a lot in the summer, especially on days like this when I need to clear my head. Once I'm in the park, the leaves absorb the chaos of the streets beyond its perimeter. There's always a stillness here. The breeze sweeps across my face. The sky is still bright, and the air is clear, but it's cool for a summer's evening. I tighten my cotton scarf around my neck. When Maya finds me, I'm wandering down the eastern edge of the Serpentine, walking in the shadow of the cafe and trying not to think of Yarrick's breath on my cheek.
Isabel?
She's already beside me by the time she speaks. When I hear my name, it doesn't make me jump. I had already registered the awkward click of stiletto heels quickening behind me. She sounds out of breath. I smirk to myself as she presses her fingertips against the perspiration on the side of her forehead. Hello, Maya. Are you walking this way? She can't fail to notice the resentment that rages below my forced politeness.
Well, no, I wasn't, actually.
Her accent teases out the last word into five separate syllables. It's infuriating.
You sure are a fast walker.
My eyes shoot from my flat brogues to her patent courts, and notice that it takes 3-inch heels to bring her to the same height as me. She must be tiny because I'm not tall. I want to ask her what she's doing here, but resist. I can't bear for her to have any kind of control over me. So we walk in silence for a while, as after-work joggers and mothers with prams pass by. I seek out glimpses of the glistening blue water from between the leaves of the trees to our right. I'm not eager to hear what she has to say.
Ain't it pretty?
She says, as if we're both tourists here together, seeing it all for the first time. Wait till we come around the other side when you can see the whole lake.
Listen, Izzy, can I call you Izzy?
Her hand darts to my arm, and I'm not feeling generous enough to give her much more than a shrug. A forced friendliness grates on me.
I'm sorry about how things went this morning, when we spoke about the single opt-in. I don't feel like we got off on the right foot, and I feel kind of bad about it.
It's fine.
You're a tough cookie, I can see that. And you obviously have strong feelings about all that stuff.
Obviously. I try but fail to keep the irritation from my voice. I stop and fold my arms as I turn to face her.
Is this what you've come to talk to me about?
Because I really don't want to discuss it in the office, let alone outside it.
No, it's not,
she says, casting her gaze around. She looks almost childlike, with her mouth drawn down in disappointment and the blonde waves bouncing around her shoulders.
Shall we carry on walking?
Yes, please. I'd like to get home. We're alone on the path now, and as she begins to speak again, I wonder whether she was waiting for such a moment.
There was something else we wanted to talk to you about.
We?
Valhalla, my firm, and a few other interested parties.
Okay, I sigh the word out.
It's kind of what you might call a job proposal.
You want me to work for you? I laugh.
Was it your twin sister in the meeting today. Did you not see that I'm a complete liability?
I'm only half joking.
No, she stops walking. I see that you're brilliant.
I stop and turn towards her, raising my eyebrows. If I had more respect for her, I could take it as a compliment.
According to Caleb, I'll effectively be working for you soon enough anyway, if the buyout goes ahead.
I mean working for us directly with a different remit.
A different remit?
There have been some incidents.
A pause before the last word fills me with a sense of dread.
A few people we've made heavens fall in the past are under federal investigation.
This captures my attention.
After they're dead?
Yeah,
she drawls.
They're under investigation for things they might have done while they were alive.
Like what?
Murder? Sure. And other stuff. Fraud. That kind of thing.
But these people must have had pretty clean records for Valhalla to create heavens for them in the first place, right?
I ask.
Or have you sunk to lower depths than I could have expected?
She seems to bat away the insult with a flick of her hand.
Clean records, yeah, of course. But that doesn't mean they haven't done wrong. There's new evidence in some of these cases, and the feds want us to help gather more to support their investigations.
Fucking hell! The FBI!
I snort with laughter, and she shoots me a warning look. A man is walking around the corner towards us, and I wait for him to pass by before continuing.
And I guess they want you and your neurologists to break with the code of ethics and hand over all their records.
We already did that. They didn't find what they needed.
I shake my head in disbelief.
I don't know why I'm shocked.
Maya is quiet for a few seconds, and I can almost hear her thinking. She's changing tack. When she speaks, her voice is lower, more serious.
They think these people did terrible things, Izzy. Murder, extortion, torture. If it's true, they don't deserve to be in the place they're in, do they?
I glance at her, and her eyes are wide. I understand what Maya is saying, and my professional integrity tells me to cut the conversation off here. But I'm curious. We round the corner, and the serpentine opens up before us. I turn away from her, wandering off the path and through the grass by the edge of the water. Maya follows me, and I hold back a giggle as she teeters on heels that are sinking into the soil. Rollerbladers and cyclists swerve and jump on the far side of the lake, a lesson in elegance. Solar panels float like miniature icebergs in the water, and ducks bob in the channels between them.
The FBI would create an artificial hell if they could, I say.
I read too much into Maya's frown.
Oh, no. Don't tell me they want me to...
No, no, no.
She shakes her dainty head. God, no.
They want to find a way of getting into the heavens of these people remotely, interfacing with the memories to search for clues, to interact with the consciousness that remains.
Well, good luck with that, because it's impossible.
Then maybe I've misjudged you.
Maya stops walking and folds her arms, arching an eyebrow at me. I walk a few more paces before I turn back to her, sighing. There's no trace of the childishness in her face any longer. She's sucking in her cheeks, and she's closing in on the only thing I care about, my professional pride.
I didn't think the word impossible was in your vocabulary. You ought to come and see our labs.
I think for a long while before answering, because I want to get the words right, for once.
I don't give a shit about your ethical dilemmas. And I have absolutely no interest in helping you. I'm not even flattered that you've asked me. The only thing I care about is my clients. I'm not going to agree to the single opt-in, and I'm certainly not going to agree to this. Go home.